Hello, this is Mark Shanton. Welcome you to the second part of Theatre Voice's regular critical roundups. We've already discussed a series of new plays, and now the same team of critics Kate Bassett, David Benedict and Patrick Marmion are talking about some major new revivals. Let's begin with the new production of Bertolt Brecht's 1939 play Mother Courage and Her Children, which reunites the creative partnership of actress Fiona Shaw in the title role and director Deborah Warner at the National, where they last collaborated on Beckett's Happy Days, and had previously also done productions of Brecht's The Good Person, Seth Swan, Richard II and The Power Book, whilst working on productions of Medea, Electro, Hedda Gabler and The Wasteland elsewhere. Kate, I assume you've followed many of those productions over the years. Do you think they benefit each other, or is there a problem with these two working together so compulsively?
I don't know. Something obviously went wrong with this production in that it wasn't ready for press night, and I found that rather surprising, actually, given that they had worked together for so long and you'd think it would go smoothly. I wonder if that was actually more to do with technicalities, but what I heard on the grapevine was there were technically it wasn't ready, they hadn't finished the tech run, and that they'd been cutting loads of the text, and so people couldn't remember the lines. I may be on my own here. I actually was surprised when I did see it that I thought the bulk of the play was quite strong and together, and I actually rather liked Fiona Shaw's vibrant, go-getting gypsy interpretation of the character. I think the downside for me was that it was rather very soft on satire of her capitalism. You know, she's a trader in the war and essentially sees her children biting the dust due to her avarice. So I think it was soft on that, but sometimes if that's Brecht's theory and should be applied in practice, sometimes I think his plays are better when it's not applied and they're more sympathetic. And she is rather, she's a kind of human, flawed, tragic figure in this, which I liked. To simplify, what I hated was I thought the bulk of the play was good. I hated the musical interludes by a guy called Duke Special, and they just seemed to drag the show to a halt and be endless and actually not be in tune with Brecht at all. So,
in any sense.
Well, one day I'm gonna agree with Kate, yet, actually, though. But not exactly. I absolutely loved the music. In fact, so much so that I went straight home and I bought some of it. But I discovered that I didn't have to buy it; I could just download it for free. I thought it was absolutely wonderful. It was a rather curious version. Maybe it's because of my Irish roots that I liked it. And he's Irish himself, and he's a strange mixture. I thought of Elton John and the Chieftains. I don't know if you ever heard of the Chieftains. It was a rather peculiar thing hearing this kind of mishmash with some White Stripes thrash thrown in as well, which I also liked. And so this is kind of, and I think it was absolutely perfect for Brecht as well, because it was actually, on the one hand, this is kind of the ballad tradition of Ireland, which exactly corresponds to the ballad tradition that Brecht is drawing on, and also there's some nice wistful torch song, especially for the hooker, you know. So I thought that the music was particularly strong, actually, and as for Fiona Shaw. I've got a soft spot for Fiona Shaw anyway, I suppose. But I do agree with Kate actually on her gypsy way of playing the role. I wouldn't see her as a gypsy though, but she struck me as a sort of bra burning rad femme who one would see around in the sort of Glastonbury area circa 1973. You know, she was that sort of really kind of jolly make do, and the satire, it seems to me, though, is taken care of by the narrative, and I think that the reversals of fortune that she has, so that I don't think that she has to concern herself with that too much.
It's funny you mention Glastonbury, because of course she just struck me as trying to do the strutting and swaggering of a rock chick, and it just kind of completely ran course to me.
She had to sing. I thought it was embarrassing.
Her on top of the car with the microphone was excruciating.
Yeah, but you can sing. You don't have to sing in tune when you're singing. I mean, after all, I mean, Brecht worked with Kurt Weill. You know, you could just sing. You could actually have a cat's chorus and nails coming down the blackboard, frankly, and that would all be part of it, I think.
But I didn't feel the pathos for a minute in the performance. I mean, that didn't move me at all. In fact, it was just...
No,
but that's a good thing. You have to understand this is Brechtian alienation, Mark, in action. So that this releases you to contemplate the rigours of the thinking which underpin it. And so that... because the other thing, this guy was writing with revolutionary intent and actually was trying to get people away from just kind of getting into kind of emotional swamps and actually understanding the terms of their existence within a kind of capitalist structure that needed to be overthrown, you know?
I think it's interestingly paired with The Power of Yes for that reason. you know, having those two together as plays about capitalism, I think, is an interesting bit of programming by Nick Heitner, actually.
From a new National Theatre production to an old one, the National in 1992 had one of its biggest ever South Bank hits when Stephen Daldry made his debut there, reviving J.B. Priestley's 1945 classic and Inspector Calls. And now it's back in the West End for the fourth time at the Novello. David, are you welcoming it back?
I am, rather slightly, to my own surprise. And when this opened at the National in 1992... I knew that it had already been done once before. The same production team did it at York Theatre Royal 3 years previously. Daldry had been asked to do a Rattigan play and hadn't been able to do it, or it hadn't worked. So he said, well, here's one I prepared earlier, and put it on. And at the time, I remember thinking that it was faintly cynical, and whilst I admired it, I had all sorts of silly quibbles about why is there music from Vertigo, a movie that was written 11 years after the play, and blah, blah, blah. And watching it this time, I went, oh, get over yourself, and just realised that this is a really fantastic opening up of a classic. Lots of people have tried to do it since, not least Rupert Gould, who tried to do the same thing with Time of the Conways, a play that couldn't withstand the treatment. This, I think, is startlingly successful, and it's, you know, had countless awards. It's been running in many forms since 1992, and it deserves to keep going.
It's so audacious, isn't it? And it still, nevertheless, feels very fresh now. I mean, you still think, no wonder Daldry went on to become the career he's had with this as a calling card.
I mean, I was similarly to David, actually. I sort of went thinking, oh God, you know, shouldn't Stephen Daldry be directing something new, which he should, actually. But actually, I ended up thinking this really deserves its revival because of now. Again, we're talking about Enron and the Power of Yes. It seems so startlingly relevant, that bit where these fat cats are sitting and they're being told that they have brought down all the people lower down the rungs. You know, they've mucked up lives lower down. And they sort of have to confess. But then they try and wheedle their way out of it. And, you know, it's kind of like they're asking for their pension anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is amazingly relevant.
Yeah.
Still.
And amazingly up to date with the sets. Still, it's still breathtaking that Ian McNeil Doll's House on stilts is astonishing. I mean, it's so ahead of its time, and you know, it feels like a musical again.
It's a very, very complete production. You know, the fact is, this team had already been working together for some time, and they still do. You know, it's the same production team that did Billy Elliot, and that shorthand of communication is clearly really operating. The way the light, when the show opens, the curtain is raised by a small child just halfway up, and you see rain in pools of light, and the way Rick Fisher's lighting bounces off the floor and the mood that it creates with the sound design and Stephen Warbeck's music, it's such a complete piece of theatre.
My one cavil, though, I should, as you put it, get over yourself. I think it's Edwardian, isn't it? So they're the rich Edwardians who are being criticised by Inspector Gould for their selfishly capitalist ways. But it was written in 1945, and then Stephen Daldry is staging it years later. So he puts this kind of outer frame on, which is kind of 1945, World War II, the sort of World War II urchins running around and indeed lifting the curtain and things. I think if you don't read the programme notes, you would not really understand that. And maybe it doesn't matter, maybe you wouldn't even notice, but I think the double time frame on stage is a bit under-explained. It's a silent time frame that would need a footnote, really.
I have an abiding allergy to productions only work once you've read the programme notes. It seems to be monumentally arrogant. But I think in this case, that although it may be slightly puzzling, where you go, wait a minute, why are they in those costumes and then the people from the house are in much older costumes, I think by the end of it, you're with it. It's a bit like watching West Wing, where they're all talking like mad for 10 minutes, and you go, I don't know what's going on, and then after 10 minutes you go, ah!
Well, also the fact that, I hope this isn't too much of a giveaway, the house kind of collapses, and it does look like a bombed house. So you do kind of get the idea that rich houses will be bombed in one way or another. in the 20th century.
Or indeed the way the play opens, in fact, that incredibly audacious thing of the doors has actually closed and that they're talking there, and you can't actually, the first 10 minutes of dialogue, you can't actually hear what they're really saying. And I suppose Audrey's saying that this is the silly old war horse of a play at this point, and you don't really need to know any of that.
Which I suspect is one of the reasons, again, why I was being really snotty when I was young, going, I don't think it's the National's job to sneer at past works. but also I really, this time, noticed the fact that because of that Doll's House thing, the way the characters stick their heads out and laugh derisively at what's going on, they stick their heads out. It's exactly like Alice in Alice in Wonderland being in the house, and when she's been having too much drink me and eat me, and she's got legs coming out of the window and arms coming out of the window, and you get this sense of sort of strange absurdity and people literally not fitting.
Also, I think the surprise for me was that the cast was so strong. It was really good. And Nicholas Wooderson, in a rather different way, he's very small as an actor, and he's in a sort of pinstripe suit, so he looks tiny but broad. And the sort of almost Rumpelstiltskin-like thing about it, it's like he is going to come and put his foot through the floorboard of their rich lives.
Kenneth Cranham was there, who created the role, who played it 796 times here and on Broadway and on tour.
And Wooderson took over from him on Broadway.
Indeed. And it was really interesting because watching Wooderson, I could remember Cranham, and they gave it very, very different energies. I'm not saying that one was better than the other. What's interesting is that the production, which you would think would be sort of programmed to take one interpretation that's controlled by the director and the team, actually did allow for Wooderson being much more attacking.
Yeah, very.
That was really interesting. I also really liked Marianne Oldham, I think her name is. Yes,
she was very good as
Sheila, who dared to make herself terribly unattractive. And then you actually, ironically, feel much more sympathetic for her.
Another play about moral conscience and justice is the 1937 play Judgment Day, being given a rare British outing at the Almeida Theatre in a new version by Christopher Hampton that follows what happens when a railway station master fails to change a signal and a fatal train crash ensues. Actually, interestingly, Stephen Daldry directed a earlier production of this at the Old Red Lion, I think. Did anybody see that? Did you see that? I've never met anybody who has, but yet that was apparently his big calling card in life. This production, James MacDonald has directed, I thought was an extraordinary piece of work.
My overwhelming thought after coming out of this production, which I really, really enjoyed, was how come I've not seen this play before? And then it's because we realised that Odin von Horvath, who wrote it, is barely done in this country. He died famously when he was standing under a tree that was struck by lightning on the Champs-Élysées in 1938, when he was 36. He'd written 19 plays, and we know very few of them, and after this one, I want to know a whole lot more. I also think it's an outstanding piece of design by Miriam Buter and lighting by Neil Austin, and it's an incredibly arresting piece of theatre.
In fact, Christopher Hampton, of course, has single-handedly kind of rehabilitated him here, hasn't he? He's included him as a character in one of his original plays and then has done several of his others.
Christopher Hampton, I think, has done a marvellous job on it, actually, and I think that this is one of the things that makes it... I'm not sure that all productions in this country would necessarily would be equal, and I think that he's, in the sense that he's really done a great job on the dialogue, and there's some really fabulous lines, and there's one of the characters threatens to spank the girl on her bottom until her teeth rattle. I've got to laugh, that one, certainly. And the butcher in it, who is he reflects about his fiance goes missing, that the bull has not been born that will be more important than Anna, he says with a tear in his eye, sort of thing. And he really captures a sort of a version of the German vernacular, and I think that really makes it bristle with life, as well as being packed with allegory and ideas.
I think it's such an interesting piece of writing that you get this story about people's duplicity and moral dilemmas, and the fact that a townsfolk hear what they want to hear and only that, and they're perfectly happy to switch sides as the circumstances allow, as, you know, good people are disguising the fact that they've done bad things and vice versa. It's so interesting in its economy. It's like there are seven scenes, and they're like snapshots. You get moments. You get none of that awful sort of... All right, the meat of the scene will arrive in 5 minutes. We're going to do... We'll do 5 minutes of setup. We'll show you the bar where the station master, played by Joseph Milson, turns up. No, he's just sitting there, and the scene starts at exactly the right moment, and it cuts at exactly the
and
right moment. It's an incredibly modern
scenes, haven't they? Yeah. In a way that takes you by surprise.
I mean, it's like a Carol Churchill play. It just cuts absolutely to the quick and shows you exactly what you need to see in order to discuss the dilemma within very, very dramatic situations.
And of course, MacDonald has directed Churchill, so no coincidence.
Yes. I mean, exactly like David, I kind of came out thinking, I can't believe I don't know this play. And I can't believe it hasn't been done in between. And again, thank you, Christopher Hampton, for getting out. But I also think it's an incredibly strong ensemble as well. And the set is it's a sort of revolving stage, but incredibly narrow. So it feels very claustrophobic and remorseless and dark at the same time. And it starts off in what could almost be UNESCO, the sign of satire of parochial dull life.
They're stuck on a train station. You never see the train, but you see the steam that the rushes steam past. And yes, it's sort of malign
gossip, and it seems satirical. And then by the end, it's just this incredibly rich, complex piece about ethics, really, about morals and bias and justice.
Well, in particular, that line as well about how the Joseph Milson character, he's very good. He has this sort of square-jawed certainty, and also which mutates, and by the end of the play, into guilty vulnerability. But of course, along with references, dark, ominous references to what to the gypsies, because of course this is all set in Hitler's Germany. There is also the clear implication that this is drifting towards the concentration camps, and Joseph Milson's plea is that he was only obeying orders and doing what he was doing, and of course that is a chilly echo for anybody today.
Except he wasn't. Except the point is he wasn't doing his duty at that point. So, I mean, it's not an easy play about Nazi mentality. The fact is this is the point where he didn't do his duty, he forgot.
He's temporarily distracted.
No, I mean it rather brilliantly plays as a piece of writing. It plays with the audience's sympathies, and I really respected James MacDonald's production for not underlining everything and showing you. And this is a moment where someone behaves badly. Everything sort of hovers, so you're not quite sure where your sympathies are supposed to quite lie, because it becomes much more complicated than you think. And people end up doing right things for wrong reasons and vice versa.
Absolutely. And also, I rather like Joseph Milson's performance in that I'm not sure he is square-jawed. There's kind of this really strange complexity that you don't know what's going on. You know, he's this nice guy who defends his rather awful wife from an attack by neighbours, and he always defends her. He never actually slags her off. But then he's just kind of icy on some level, and he's lying straight, no expression, keeps lying about an atrocity he's caused, really. And then also, as an actor, he's very good at tenderness, really, isn't he? And so he has a relationship with this young girl, which is, because of the way he plays it, full of yearning. And so all those things are going on at once, and you're not really sure.
Which, of course, means that the audience is never... We're never secure, because we don't know where we stand with relation to those characters, which makes it completely gripping, because neither the production nor the play are underlining, okay, and this is what you need to think, so you can just settle back. You're constantly being held going, yes, but what do I make of that?
And the set also very cleverly constantly changes your perspective of
And I do love the fact that Miriam Boucher has literally taken the stage out of the Almeida. You've got a catwalk that's on wheels.
Slow spinning.
That very, very slowly turns, so that after about 10 minutes you go, hang on a minute, wasn't the stage facing the other way? You don't see it happen, and which is a fantastic metaphor for exactly what's happening in the play.
Yes, and it manages to be fluid and remorseless, because you get the sense of thing cogs turning, and yet it also means that all the jump cuts just happen very easily.
It's the sort of thing that, as we describe it, it sounds sledgehammer to crack walnut, sort of really obvious metaphor.
Yeah, but it's and in not, fact, it just plays. It's not really a metaphor. You know, it's just that's the atmosphere it creates. It makes it feel claustrophobic.
From one rare revival to another rare revival, at least on these shores, the 1955 Broadway War Horse Inherit the Wind, based on the true story of an American schoolteacher on trial for teaching Darwin's theory of evolution. Kevin Spacey and David Troughton appear as lawyers for the defence and prosecution, respectively, in Trevor Nunn's production. Kate, have you seen this play before?
No, I haven't. No, I haven't.
I saw the Broadway revival a couple of years ago with Christopher Plummer and Charles Durning. It worked really well there, and they put the audience, the jury, on the stage for some of it. And here they put the jury in the front row of the stalls. It's a really interesting, I mean, it's a stodgy old play, but a really fascinating one, I think.
Yeah, I had quite a few problems with the play, just because it's creaky in lots of ways. You know, you can see every button being pushed and every cog turning. But for me, it wasn't so much Trevor Nunn's production and where the jury was. It was really the core performances by Kevin Spacey. Well, actually, mostly Kevin Spacey, but also David Troughton. I mean, I thought the core courtroom drama was very ripping and witty and entertaining. I have quite a few doubts about the play itself.
Patrick, do you share those doubts?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it was great fun, but it's pure slapstick, of course. You know, and it's quite amusing to me that I think that Trevor Nunn actually, in some ways, has attempted to take it seriously. You know, frankly, it's just knockabout stuff, isn't it? With David Troughton as a sort of Falstaffian figure who swallowed the St. James's Bible, spouting all this kind of nonsense, and he reminded me actually of Widow Twankey as well as Falstaff. And then in the other corner, in this kind of fight that might have been fixed by Don King, you know, with the inevitable outcome, and of course, you know, that Kevin Spacey is going to win, because otherwise he wouldn't have taken the role. And but he's terribly good fun too, isn't he? Anyway, he sort of rounds his shoulders and he stoops down. He's got, you wouldn't recognise him in this white wig that he's got on, and he's trying to play someone about 25 years, I'm guessing, older than him. But the withering glares that he issues and so on, and his goading, his scoffing are great fun, but they are at the level of putting a custard pie in someone's face.
And actually, Kevin Spacey does lose, in fact, but never mind.
Well, he doesn't lose. Well, he loses. In theory, he loses, but we all know he won, you know. That's the whole point, isn't it? I mean, actually, he's exonerated in his losing, because he proves his point in that way.
But these are two big parts that actors obviously love playing.
Yeah, I mean, I have my problems really much the same as Kate's. I mean, the argument in the play is entirely stacked. And as Patrick says, you know, guess which role Kevin Spacey's playing? Well, it would be the one that has all the moral victory. You know, do you want to play the 19th century based conservative, or do you want to be the one that the audience is going to be with, which is the free thinking? I have law and justice on my side. I think that Kevin Spacey is slightly on repeat now. I mean, we've seen countless performances where he prowls the stage. He's got great timing. He physically changes himself. He shifts his centre of gravity, so he sort of pushes the top of his spine up, which pushes his head down, which makes him look fantastically watchful.
And older.
And older. Yeah. And he has that stoop, which does slightly disappear towards the end. He is very, very good. His performances, when they're at their best, are fueled by cold rage, and he gets to do quite a lot of that. So you get very unanticipated moments where he will suddenly flash with anger about something, and that's very arresting, and that works. My real problems are with the production. This is half an hour longer than the Broadway production, because at the beginning you have Inherit the Wind, the musical. You get William Billings-style American hymns, you get bring and buy sales, you get this extraordinary, huge portrait of a town with 23 adult actors, 17 extras, 6 children, and 1 live rhesus monkey. I mean, how much did that monkey cost? The monkey will be paid much more than almost anybody in that cast.
David, it's Trevor Nunn, of course. What do you expect?
It's maximalist theatre. Something happened to Trevor Nunn. Why did he suddenly get so literal? Trevor Nunn used to direct some of the most magically metaphorical, exciting pieces of theatre one could ever wish to see. And now everything is spelt out out in obvious.
I'm afraid I similarly, I mean, that was my main problem with the production, was the chorus. It's like, I don't need a chorus to come between each scene and sing a hymn downstage centre.
It's a courtroom drama. Do the courtroom drama.
No, absolutely.
Well, actually, what I thought was interesting about that, the way that he did it, or interesting in the kind of significant sort of way, should we say, that is that it rendered it sort of accidentally nostalgic. And although, of course, you know, Trevor Nunn is aligning himself with Kevin Spacey, he accidentally, you know, his fondness for the kind of the cherry wood shaker look of and also for the everyone sort of swaying to the kind of the Jesus-y sounds of Amazing Grace, you know, that he betrays his kind of sentimental core. Well, so I think that Trevor Nunn sort of takes the rationalist side with Kevin Spacey, but at the same time he's sort of the production has a kind of creationist heart.
Well, I mean, though I don't favour it, I think you might argue that putting those hymns in was a way to try and rebalance the play musically to make one sympathetic with the religious side, but actually I found it rather dull.
And I did think that whilst Trevor has pushed both performances to extremes, David Troughton comes out of this extraordinarily well. I mean, it is a huge performance. That's all you've got to do, really. If you've got Kevin Spacey undercutting with sarcasm your every move, you're going to have to provide something very, very big. And I think that Troughton really pulls it off with the performance, as you say, Patrick. You know, it could be Widow Twanky. It's eye rolling. You know, he is a man that ends up having a heart attack in front of our eyes, and his conviction is sweated out in front of us. I think that is pretty impressive.
I'd just like to talk a little bit about the sweat. There isn't any.
Well, yes.
It's meant to be 97 degrees. Everyone has got fans. Not a single person has got a damp armpit.
Interestingly, the Old Vic seems to be actually air-conditioned at last. So that probably is why.
That's an attempt to create the real situation. I mean, that is a bit basic.
I mean, it was very interesting comparing that with Rob Ashford's production of Streetcar Named Desire, where nobody mopped a hanky to their brow, but everybody moved like their clothes stuck to them. You got an absolute sense of heat. Here, you got a lot of people fanning themselves.
And finally, Shakespeare's Othello is also back in the West End, thanks to the casting of Lenny Henry in the title role in Northern Broadside's production, first seen at the West Yorkshire Playhouse earlier this year, and now at the Trafalgar Studios. Patrick, did you see it in London or in Leeds?
I saw it in Leeds, and, good luck to him, I think, really, you know, Lenny Henry, but he's not really cut out to do this. He doesn't have the range. And he doesn't really pull it off. And Conrad Nelson's Iago opposite him is a kind of is a rather ridiculous moustache turning dastardly villain, and the whole thing is really a bit plodding and predictable. Although he does, in his favour, have a kind of booming RSC or rotundity to him, so you know he has that in his favour.
And this is a production that probably wouldn't have come to the West End but for the star power.
Yes, I'm afraid I wish it hadn't. I was rather taken with Lenny Henry. I suspect that given that it was his first Shakespeare, he has grown into it following the Leeds opening and the tour. I didn't see it then. I caught it in town. But I thought that whilst he doesn't quite pull off the final couple of acts, lots of people don't pull off the final couple of acts. They're very, very hard to play. I mean, Chiwetel Ejiofor did it brilliantly at the Donmar, but it's a tough road to hoe. And I thought that he had weight, he had a degree of gravitas, he had power, and he had authority, which you absolutely need in this role. My problem was the rest of the production. I thought that Desdemona was really terribly weak. And Conrad Nelson, as you say, Patrick, it's one note. Everybody in this play says honest Iago. Absolutely everybody in this play confides in him. He has to be utterly convincing as everybody's best friend, nice guy and confidant. And you think, wouldn't you trust Conrad Nelson as far as you can throw him?
What about you, Kate?
Just sort of sorely disappointing, really. I thought I didn't like Lenny Henry as much as you did. I did sit in Leeds, though, rather than London, so he may have got into the swing of it more. I thought he's got an amazing kind of deep, rich voice. When I saw it, he was rushing his lines very badly, though. And I found him physically stiff on stage. I mean, he looked as if he didn't know what to do with his hands in a slightly kind of amateur way. And really, I just thought the directing was very low on insights. I just thought it was adequate at best, really.
The blocking was bad. There was sort of, I mean, I saw it at the Trafalgar Studios, which is not a very welcoming space to either audience or staging. But, you know, Rory Murchison has a four-poster bed on the stage. You know, there's always the problem with this place: how do you get the bed on? What do you do with this? But it sort of stood there, and then you have scenes away from it, and the way it's very poorly lit, you can't work out what the logic of the space is, which takes you out of the drama because you're trying to puzzle your way through it. And just the relationships and different statuses between characters was left completely open. I mean, I know I am standing here as the defence counsel for Lenny Henry. He wasn't rushing lines by the time he saw him in London. I mean, yeah. You know, this is the man's first Shakespeare. It's a huge role. And I don't think it's the great a performance of Othello of our age, but I think it's a more than credible, cogent performance.
If it's his first Shakespeare, it's, you know, it's
and an it's interesting, David, you pointed out the problems of the Trafalgar Studios. Of course, the Trafalgar Studios opened in its current incarnation with a production of Othello from the RSC that Greg Doring directed with Anthony Scher as Iago, and that was far more successful, wasn't it? I mean, clearly, the Northern Broadsides, I mean, do fantastic work in their way, but it's a very particular way of working,
But on the strength of this, I'm not sure what it is, what that great work is, other than touring to places that the RSC don't go
exactly.
to. You know, the idea that if you do something in a Yorkshire accent, it somehow makes it more valid and that it will speak more strongly to people, I think is unbelievably patronising if the quality of the direction and production is going to be as poor as this. Because I just don't believe that. I think if you take great productions that are absolutely focused around really strong narrative drive with real insight, it doesn't matter whether they speak in posh RP like me or in a Leeds accent.
Sometimes I do like hearing Shakespeare in other accents. In the very first scene where they say, what is it, a black ram is tapping your white ewe, the Yorkshire accents kind of worked. He went, there is really earthy, natural imagery, though the setting is Venice. Kind of Venice of the North, you know. But then I thought the accents didn't work. Amelia, who is the servant of Desdemona, sounded posher than Desdemona, so none of the status really worked. So I began to feel as if the accents
sadly, Amelia is one of the great female roles in Shakespeare. It's a fantastic part. Zoe Wanamaker did it for Trevor Nunn, and Michelle Fairley was absolutely staggering for Michael Grandage at the Donmar. I mean, she actually got away with beating the floor. You'd think, Isn't there an actor's handbook which says, don't beat the floor, because we'll never believe you? We believed her. She was fantastic. And in this, because of the direction, Amelia was really routine, and she should stop your heart. This is the most brilliantly plotted of all the Shakespeare tragedies. It should play like a thriller. And the audience was sort of nodding and admiring various bits and quite liking some of it. That's not good enough.
I mean, it's a shame, because I think, you know, casting Lenny Henry, it will have got more people to go and see Othello it would have got some people to go and see it who wouldn't have seen it, but I just think it's a shame it wasn't a better production.
Yeah, well, if it was your first, I mean, Morgan, his first Shakespeare, but if it was your first Shakespeare going to see it, I'm not sure it would encourage you to see any more.
On that note, thank you, Patrick, David and Kate.